This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to Radio Astronomy, the podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine. You can subscribe to the print edition of the magazine by visiting skyatnightmagazine.com or to our digital edition by visiting iTunes or Google Play.
Thank you, listeners, for joining us for our special podcast all about the Moon as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing. I'm news editor Elizabeth Pearson, and I'm joined in the studio today by editor Chris Bramley.
Hello.
Production editor Neil McKim.
Hello.
And staff writer Ian Todd.
Hello.
Coming up later in this episode, we'll be talking to James Burke, the former presenter of Tomorrow's World, who reported on the Apollo missions for the BBC. And we'll tell you our top stargazing sight to see in this month's night sky. On the 21st of July 1969, Neil Armstrong made history by becoming the first human being to ever set foot on the moon. Here at BBC Sky and Night magazine, we've taken a look back over the mission in both our July and August issues.
Yes, an event so big and momentous that we had to do it twice.
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean, it really is. It's one of the most historic events, I think, in history. Mm-hmm. Certainly one of the greatest engineering feats that has ever
well, it's,
happened.
Well, it's one of those things that when people talk about, you know, a big momentous occasion now, people talk about the moonshot, trying to do something impossible. Mm. So it's kind of entered into people's vocabulary. So
yeah, there's that thing, isn't there? Like if something goes wrong, people say, well, you know, we can put man on the moon, but we can't, blah, blah, blah.
That's right.
It's part
that's
of vernacular
right.
now.
Yeah, no, it is. It's kind of entered popular culture. It's so good. I mean, one of the things that has been really interesting this issue is the work we did on the landing sites, actually, and all the stuff around that, which is such an interesting thing, because I was looking into how they were chosen, and NASA spent a very long time and set up an Apollo site selection board to take everything into consideration and make sure that they had all the information and base it on, you know, really really good data and stuff. So they had surveyor landers on the moon already, mm-hmm. And they also had the lunar orbiter spacecraft orbiting the moon at the time. And I think by about 1967, it had photographed 99% of the lunar surface. So they had these really quite detailed maps, and they were poring over them, looking for sites that were smooth and obstacle free, so that the lunar module wouldn't encounter any uneven terrain when it landed.
It's kind of incredible the time scales when you're talking about Apollo, because you kind of think, oh, sure, this must have been decades in the planning. But when you think, like, Kennedy's speech was like, what, 61 or 62?
61, I think. Yeah. They said, they sort of signed the legislation of we are going to the moon in 1962. Yeah.
Before they even knew how they were going to do it?
Yes, yeah. they were in the early 60s, sort of 1960, 61, they were only just doing the Ranger mission, which was literally, we're going to send a robot up there and smash into it. Mm. And then, you know, 8 years later, they're managing to put a person
thing,
down.
There? Yeah. But it's not just the kind of how do you get a person to the moon or a crew to the moon. It's how do you, you know, you've got to build the vehicle to get there. Mm. You've got to recce the landing site.
Yeah.
You've got to do all these things, but you've got to all do them at exactly the same time as well. So, you know, a kind of
and work out how you're going to get them back.
Yeah.
Yes, that was the important thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's the caveat.
Indeed.
And
indeed.
Bring them back.
Yeah. So one of the, I mean, it wasn't just the geography on the moon that was they considered. The other thing they had to consider was how much fuel the lunar module had. It had, you know, they had to take that into consideration.
I think that was why most of them, if you look at all of the landing sites, are all around the equator.
Yes.
Because the spin of the moon gives you a little bit of a extra boost to get back off again.
Yeah, that's right. So you don't need to carry as much fuel and you're not so heavy then. Yeah, that's right. And the other thing that I thought was really interesting was that they, it wasn't just that, they had to take lighting into consideration as well. So they had to look at the phase of the moon at the time that they were going to be there and pick somewhere that was well lit enough so that the crew could use the craters and other features for navigation. So they had, you know, they were, it would be no good at kind of when the Terminator was sweeping past and it was all in darkness and we can't see anything. You know? And it was just as well that the that they was in daylight, because when they actually came to land, this is the famous thing where Neil Armstrong took manual control from the Apollo guidance computer, and for the last kind of 150 meter of the descent to the lunar surface, flew it manually. And this is when you had people in mission control tearing their hair out, saying, you know, 60 seconds of fuel left, 30 seconds of fuel left. And because they, when he got to about 150 meters, he saw that there was a boulder field and they were heading right for that, and it would have been a nightmare to land on it. So he took manual control and flew over to a space that was a bit smoother.
This is the thing that gets me when you look at these sort of early space missions, is you sort of don't realize just exactly how basic the technology was. I mean, everybody talks about, you know, your washing machine has more processing power than Apollo 11. But if you look back at like the very early lunar probes, they had on board film. Like chemically, that they had to chemically develop on board and then read in. The timers were all clockwork.
Crazy, isn't it? Yeah.
People had to do everything by hand. They did something with that technology that we can't do today.
Mm. Yeah, they didn't. I mean, they didn't even have pocket calculators.
No,
you know, just even stuff like that you would take for granted.
Yeah, they had like slide rules and things.
Yes.
I think I was looking at a photo the other day, and it was Ed White in I think it was a Gemini mission. When he went out for one of the first spacewalks, and he had a funny thing in he was carrying a thing that looked like a small radiator in his hands, and that was a maneuverability device. So it was literally a handheld, a couple of gas canisters and a nozzle, and with a handle that you pressed, you pushed the handle, and a little bit of gas flew out, and it moved you over where you wanted to go.
If it works.
It worked. And you know, that develops into kind of obviously Bruce McCandless on the space shuttle.
Oh, yeah.
When he was in this awesome chair with joysticks, and he was like, you know, moving around and stuff. That's the kind of thing you imagine. But it all started out, you know, like very, very basic. It's so interesting. Yeah.
But just thinking back to that landing, and just the ability for Armstrong and Aldrin to just stay cool under pressure. I mean, I think it goes without saying that, you know, had I been in charge of landing the lunar lander, I don't think we would have. Don't think we would have made it. I mean, it's unbelievable.
The
just,
number yeah. of yeah. things that went wrong, yeah. as well as the yeah. the having to take up manual control, they nearly had to abort, I think, three times for various different reasons. When Buzz went to open the hatch, he couldn't because the pressure hadn't equalized properly, and he had to peel back the seal with his fingers to release that last bit of pressure to get the door open. And it's like, no, there's another problem. We've dealt with it. We'll move on. Another problem. Yeah. Dealt with it. We'll move on.
Yeah, I mean, you can see what, like, why they kind of choose fighter pilots as Apollo astronauts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, who else is going to keep cool under...
Fighter pilots and test pilots. Yeah. And back up on the moon, they, you know, when they got out, when they did peel back the seal, eventually got out, they got out and left behind a lot of equipment. And experiments and things that, they can't be seen from Earth because they're just too small, even with the biggest telescopes. But in 2011, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which orbits the moon at a height of 50 kilometres, managed to take a very high resolution image of the surface, and it managed to capture all the kind of science apparatus there, the seismic experiment package, the laser ranging retroreflector, and even the tracks that the astronauts created when they made their EVA, their extravehicular activity, and they travelled. They walked about a kilometre in the 2.5 hours that they spent on the lunar surface. They walked up to the edge of a little crater that they landed next to, and took a picture of the lunar module sitting there, and then collected some samples and stuff. So, you know, all that stuff has been imaged from lunar orbit, so we know it is still there.
Yeah. And I think it was like maybe a month or two ago, like even now they're still getting data from it. There was a study that came out about moonquakes and kind of new data showing that the moon is shrinking and it's causing these quakes. And that was all from, well, not all from, but it was a lot of the data came from those seismometers that the Apollo astronauts put in the moon.
Yes, no, that's interesting. It's not just the moonquakes; it's the lunar ranging retroreflector has helped them measure the speed at which the moon is actually drifting away from from the Earth.
So that's like a device that they have on the moon. You fire a laser at it from Earth, it bounces off, comes straight back to the person, and you can tell by the time that it takes very, very precisely exactly the distance that retroreflector is away.
Yeah. But it's not just all this useful scientific stuff that they left on the moon. I think you've been looking at some interesting things, haven't you, Neil?
I've been looking at some of the weird stuff, some of the junk that's been left on the moon, and there's loads and loads of rubbish on there, and they reckon it weighs about 181,000 kilograms.
What?
And that's including the rovers and the
all the
descent stages and everything.
Not just their crisp packets.
Yeah, that's right. But there are some interesting artifacts. There's 96 bags of human waste.
Good Lord.
Okay. That's a lot.
Yeah. Apparently these were they were called defecation collection devices.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Charming.
And those have been left there. And apparently biologists are interested in researching these to see what sort of state they're in, if they ever get them.
Because they've been sat on the moon being subjected to
radiation.
All that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But there's a whole variety of stuff that was left partly intentionally. And there was a silicon disc that's got microscopic messages from world leaders, which was taken up on Apollo 11. And 73 countries were involved in this, and it's the size of a 50-cent piece.
Amazing.
And there's an ancient NASA press release, which is all hand-typed, and it's got these messages all spelt out. And they've got some quite surprising people on there of the time. Chiang Kai-shek from China, wants world peace through the universe, and military dictator Joseph Mobutu of the Democratic Republic of Congo has put a message talking about the conquest of space in order to make man its master.
Okay. Yeah.
Slightly different point of view there.
Goodness, yeah.
And there's also very encouraging words from our own Queen, who salutes the skill and courage which brought men to the moon.
That's a nice one.
That's a good
one.
Cool.
Wow, that's
excellent.
But amongst the other things, there's $20 bills and $2 bills brought by Dave Scott and Jim Irvin on Apollo 15. And they took them up as they wanted to be moon touch souvenirs. So they wanted to take them up to the surface and then bring them back. But they left quite a lot up there. So there's a lot of cash still up there.
Yeah.
There's more well-known stuff, like there's a picture of Charlie Duke's family with his wife and two kids. Mm. And there's also the two golf balls that Alan Shepard was firing with his six iron that he'd attached to a lunar excavator handle.
Nice.
The thing I like about that is apparently, is it Charlie Duke, did you say? Yeah.
Yeah. Alan Shepard.
Alan Shepard. Yeah, yeah. He apparently smuggled the golf club on board.
Oh, right. Okay.
I'm not entirely sure how you managed to, considering the number of people that they would have been like reweighing that, checking everything, but he somehow managed to sneak it on board.
Probably had it down his trouser leg and was just walking. Yeah. He pretended he had a stiff knee or something like that.
Yeah. Ooh, I've got a bit of a limp today. I'm fine.
They probably don't have customs, do they?
No. I know they did have pretty stringent planetary protection though.
They weren't
so concerned about what you took up, provided, you know, it wasn't a corned beef sandwich that was gonna get in the controls, which I believe happened to somebody. But
it was just that, like, all the weight was accounted for, wasn't it? Every single gram had to be necessary, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So and NASA have said that they're hoping that future missions will be able to analyze all this rubbish and see how it's been weathered by radiation and the vacuum of space.
That's interesting. Tell us something about how the materials kind of perform in
over a long
period of time.
And that's something also with the flags. There's seven flags, five of which are still standing apparently.
Yeah.
One of them, Buzz Aldrin reported, was knocked over by Apollo 11.
One of the things that I found out when I was looking up about Apollo 11 was apparently the flag was just bought from a local store.
They
sort of got towards the end of the mission and went, oh, we're going to need a flag, and had to send somebody out to go and grab one.
Yeah.
Like, you think these incredibly historic images were just somebody's last minute idea.
Apparently it was bought in a shop in Houston, Texas for $5.50.
Yes.
And I suppose like the flag is kind of one of the main things, because we did want to talk about kind of conspiracy theories a bit in this podcast. Not kind of giving them too much weight, but at least discussing them. And one of the things that people mostly talk about is why did the flag flutter or appear to flutter in as if there's wind? And this kind of leads people to think that, you know, NASA had faked the whole thing. I mean, you can watch the flag planting on YouTube. And if you watch it, I mean, it doesn't flutter beyond them twisting it into the ground, which is it's going to flutter anyway. And it was like it was hemmed at the top and there was like a horizontal boom, I guess. So that's why it just sits draped. And shortly after they've finished fixing it into the ground, obviously because there's less air resistance, it kind of flutters a bit longer than you would normally expect. But it does just stay still. When you're watching it, when you watch the flag planting video back, you kind of think, what are they on about? It doesn't really flutter.
I mean, it follows the laws of physics, doesn't it? I mean, if you twist something, it's going to follow suit and move in that direction. So that's all it's doing, isn't it?
Exactly. And I suppose the other big conspiracy theory is people kind of say in the photos why there are no stars in the background. And it's something that people still people still talk about whenever you get photos of astronauts on the ISS performing spacewalks. People kind of say, why are there no stars in the background? But I always kind of think that, like, if you take one of those photos on a summer evening of your family, maybe you're outside in a barbecue and it's got dark and you take a photo, you can't see the stars in the night sky even if it's clear. It's just all about exposure, isn't it?
If someone manages to take a single exposure of a person in perfect light with the stars in the background, I would be very impressed. You have to leave exposure for at least several seconds, at which point your person's completely blown out.
That's right.
People often point to the Van Allen belts, which are these kind of areas of high energy charged particles that surround Earth. How did the astronauts get beyond them? Well, like, NASA was aware of that, and they kind of charted a course and made sure that it wouldn't really affect them. But in any case, they were going quite quickly through them. It wasn't like they kind of lingering around, and they were obviously shielded by the spacecraft, which was designed to deal with that radiation.
That's right. Interestingly, the astronauts did report seeing flashes of white in their vision, even when they closed their eyes, and that was actually highly charged particles passing through them.
Yeah, the apparently the ISS astronauts still get that sometimes.
Yeah,
not as much. Yeah, they sort of still, they're trying to get to sleep, and suddenly there's this bright flash of light. Which is a cosmic ray hitting their retina.
And it's obviously, it's something that, especially with like Scott Kelly's year in space, like the kind of twin experiment that he and his brother did, we still don't really know the effects of the radiation from space on the human body. And it's something that kind of scientists are still trying to work out. But I suppose one of the other main conspiracy theories that people kind of come up with is, you know, why haven't we been back to the moon? But like, we have, if you think about it, because like China's Chang'e 4 recently landed on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which has taken images of the lunar landing sites. Mm. And, you know, there are plenty of kind of future lunar missions in the pipeline now, aren't there?
Yeah, that's right.
There definitely was a big gap. The last missions to the moon were actually the robotic ones that were done by the Soviet Union at the time. And they actually, not many people realize this, but the Soviet Union actually did send a sample return mission of their own. It was just robotic. Luna 16, 20 and 24 all returned a sample from the moon. After that, it was about another 37 years, I think it is, before somebody actually went back to the moon. And that was Chang'e 3 a couple of years ago. And that is the first stage of China's Chang'e program. They've currently sent two rovers, one to the near side, the last to the far side. They've grown the first plants on the surface of the moon, which was one of the experiments on Chang'e 4. And Chang'e 5 is going back in a minute and hoping to do another sample return mission. So again, a robotic one. But that's all part of their plan to eventually send their own taikonauts, as they're called. English speakers have astronauts, the Russians have cosmonauts, and the Chinese have taikonauts. Indian ones are called Vyomnauts, I believe, as well.
Oh, right.
Which are ones that are going to be coming in a bit.
Vyomnauts.
Vyomnauts. Nice. I think that's how you pronounce
good.
It.
Yeah.
Which is Sanskrit for space. But that's all part of the Chinese plan to get a human onto the surface of the moon and eventually onto Mars. And of course, NASA have their own program. They've been for several the past couple of decades, they've been trying to sort of slowly work towards a more permanent lunar mission. Because one of the big problems that you had with Apollo was it was so big, it was such a big moment that the problem that you have when you have a big moment like that is once the moment's passed, everybody stops caring. And that was what happened with the Apollo missions, is after Apollo 11, nobody was really paying attention anymore, and just there wasn't the political will and people went, didn't want to go back.
A while ago, I was interviewing Jack Clemmons, who was an Apollo engineer at the time, and he said that for Apollo 13, no one paid any attention until it went wrong.
It's like, if you've ever seen the film, there's the sort of like, nobody cares, it's not on any of the news channels, and then suddenly everybody's paying attention. But this time, NASA are planning a much more long-term plan. Get to the moon, potentially put some kind of permanent base down there, whether that's a robotic one or a human one or some kind of combination of the two, which is most likely, and then eventually go on to Mars. Their big plan is the Artemis mission, and that's the plan to put a human down, specifically the first woman down, by 2024.
Mm-hmm.
Probably a bit of an ambitious date. Probably going to be more like 2028, 2030. They're aiming for 24. I really like the name Artemis as well, because it's Artemis in Greek mythology was the twin sister of Apollo.
That's both it?
That kind of harking back to Apollo and also the fact they're trying to put the first woman on the moon as well. And in order to get to the moon, they're going to use this thing called the Lunar Gateway, which is sort of a space station which goes between Earth and it's around the moon, and you can go to the gateway and then go down to the moon.
Nice.
So again, it's a part of that long-term goal.
Yeah.
And they are in the process of starting to build that now.
Yes.
So hopefully we'll see that coming in the future.
And they, of course, are getting on with their their vehicle for that, aren't they? The SLS rocket and the Orion capsule.
The Space Launch System, which is a very straightforward name.
Yes.
Or SLS, which is their answer to the Saturn V.
It's almost the size of a Saturn V.
It's almost the size of a Saturn V. That's one of the things that always kind of gets me, is they have this incredibly huge rocket. And we can't build one of those now. We don't know how. But it's also because each Saturn V costs something like $1 billion each.
Yeah.
They were a little bit expensive, which is why they stopped building them.
Mm, mm.
It's also cool when you can hear about kind of discoveries of water ice in the far side and how that could be used, you know, potentially to as a resource if you had a base on the moon.
Yeah, in the shadows of the craters. Yeah. Water is very useful. Mm. Not only do people drink it, you split it apart and you get rocket fuel.
Yeah.
Or oxygen to breathe.
Oxygen? Would that work?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Cool.
I think actually there's going to be a thing on one of the Mars rovers, Mars 2020, I think, which is the NASA one. Like a little experiment to see whether they can do that with the carbon dioxide in Mars's atmosphere.
Awesome.
So that's, you know, sort of looking even further forward, because that's now everybody, when you talk about getting people onto the moon, it's always looking forward to getting people onto Mars.
That's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Apollo 11 has been this incredibly historic moment, and it's been one of those moments that everybody remembers where they were when the landing happened. So this month, we asked people to get in touch via our social media pages to let us know what they were doing during the Apollo 11 landing. Here's a few of our favourites.
Yeah, John Dickinson got in touch on Facebook, and he had a really interesting story because his dad was working at the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station, which is in Australia near Canberra. And it was an Earth station that helped NASA track Apollo 11 and also played a part in broadcasting the TV footage. And he said, I was 5 years old. My dad wasn't home because he was working at the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station, receiving the signal from Apollo. Children from my preschool came to our home and we watched the first humans land on the moon. I remember being very proud of my dad, even though I didn't understand how he was helping.
Lovely.
Yeah, there's quite a few sort of people were very young, because obviously it was 50 years ago, but they still managed to remember it. Like Angie Jukes. I was 4 years old and being told by my brother, you'll want to remember this, as cool parquet flooring pressed into my legs, sitting cross-legged, watching a grainy image. Tranquility Base, the eagle has landed, meant nothing to me at four, but raises hair every time I hear it.
Definitely. You do still get that kind of goosebumpy effect from the Apollo stuff.
Yeah.
Also on Facebook, slightly older, David Jones, who is 9 years old, says, I was 9 years old at primary school in Greenwich. My teacher was a keen amateur astronomer, Mr. McGee. I already had an interest from the Apollo 8 missions, so he let me and some friends watch coverage on a large TV in the library. We later went to the Royal Observatory about a mile away, and I remember us all looking up at the moon and realising there were two men stood on it.
Mm. Wow, there must have been some powerful telescopes.
But I think, that sort of the feeling of being able to go out and look up and know there's people walking on that right now.
That must be incredible, isn't it? Yeah, that's amazing. The one I particularly liked was Andrew Graysman, who said, I remember not being allowed to stay up and watch the landing.
No.
I was 10 years old and my parents were uninterested. My argument that it was history in the making did not go down well with my mother, who said, it will still be history tomorrow.
That's crazy. That's one of the most parental things I've ever heard.
And those are days when they didn't even have any videos. They didn't even have VCRs back then.
Yeah.
Did they?
So, you couldn't watch it back in the iPlayer.
That was it.
Luckily, it has proliferated and you can find it everywhere on the internet, and it'll be all over TV, I'm sure. So thank you to everybody who sent those in. If you have anything you'd like to ask us here on Radio Astronomy, you can drop us a line via our Facebook page, our Twitter handle, @SkyNightMag, or email us at contactus@skynightmagazine.com.
Those who were lucky enough to watch the moon landings might remember James Burke, who reported on all the missions for the BBC. We caught up with him ahead of his appearance at the Blue Dot Festival. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk about the Apollo mission this morning.
Pleasure.
Can I begin by asking what it was like being chief reporter of the team covering this epic event for the BBC, which had a UK audience of 22 million viewers?
Well, I suppose scary in one word, because it was one of those things where you only got one shot at it. You know, if you got something stupid or wrong, that was it. I mean, it was live and it was a very big audience and you couldn't afford to make mistakes. So I suppose the atmosphere in the studio was nervous, perhaps is the best word.
Okay. And it must have been one of the BBC's first all-night broadcasts.
It was indeed. I mean, after they landed, I was the guy really responsible for following everything on the flight plan. And it became clear not long after they touched down that they were not doing the things you do when you're preparing to go to sleep. They were doing the things you do when you're preparing to get out. And we went off the air during that period, and I went up to the gallery and control gallery and said, listen, guys, they're doing stuff that you do when you get out. And they said, you do realize that if we stay on, this will be the first time on air all night. And if they don't get out, your job is ended. And I said, yeah, OK. and they did. I mean, because they were going to supposed to have a sleep. And so were we. But they didn't. So we stayed on the air that night, 11 at night until 10:30 the next morning.
Can you describe what it was like in the studio when the lunar module crew landed and took their first steps?
Well, sort of relief, because most of Apollo 11 was a radio program, really. I mean, there was only one TV broadcast on the way out, and then there was going to be 2.5 hours on the moon's surface, and then one coming back. So although we were on the air a great deal listening to what they were talking about, it was really much more listening and explaining than anything else. And that's nervous-making because, you know, the one thing you never want to do is to talk when an astronaut's talking, but you don't know when they're going to talk. So you were speaking, but with one ear very cocked to hear if they were drawing breath to say something, and then you'd shut up. And landing was 13 minutes from 50,000 feet down to the surface. Landing was entirely sound only, and there was a lot going on, and it was, you know, a bit sweaty because this was the riskiest bit of the entire mission, and we couldn't see anything, and we could only hear what they were hearing from the capsule communicator, the private line between them and the flight director's loop. We couldn't hear. So we didn't know how many things were happening on the way down that were really hairy. I mean, we knew what we thought was pretty hairy, and then they landed, and then we saw the pictures, and then things got much easier because, you know, once they're out there bouncing around and talking, you can shut up.
Can you describe what the studio was like?
Well, the studio was, you know, a big empty studio with what we thought was a futuristic set. It looks very old-fashioned now. And really, just Patrick Moore and me and Sir Bernard Lovell at Jodrell Bank by link. And, you know, the three of us talked our way through. We had backup movie. I mean, I'd been to Houston and the Cape before each mission and filmed, you know, everything that moved. Talked to everybody who would talk, and if it wasn't a person, I got into it, you know, like spacecraft and so on. So there was a lot of backup film to run, which we used from time to time when, for example, they were sleeping but we were on the air, or when we thought there wasn't much happening and that they wouldn't be talking much. We ran a bit of stuff, either interviews with the astronauts themselves or with mission controllers and scientists, geologists and so on at Houston. So there was a lot of juggling going on.
And were there any surprises during the broadcast?
Well, there was only one big surprise, and except it wasn't big because we didn't realise there were much bigger ones going on that we didn't know about. When the computer alarms came up towards the middle or the end of the final descent, what was called 1201 and 1202, and they sounded quite scary, but we didn't realise that what they were was simply an overlap of a couple of radar systems. And Houston turned one off, and then everything was okay. But for a moment or two, that sounded a bit scary because they were getting down towards the surface. But what we didn't know was much more scary than that. And that was that when they separated from the mother craft, the docking tunnel between the two spacecraft contains air, of course. And then you go into the lunar module and you shut the door, shut the hatch between you and the docking tunnel. But when they did that, there was more air in the docking tunnel than they thought, and it kind of pushed the lunar module a little bit more than was supposed to. So they were going sort of 3 or 4 seconds ahead of their schedule on the way down, which meant that when they got down there quite late on, like 2,000 feet up, they realized that they were going to be landing 4 miles past the lunar landing site. And the landing site was well covered by photographs and descriptions and blah, blah from Apollo 10. But that was going to be no good. And I heard, all I heard give us a clue was Armstrong at one point saying boulders. Now, the one thing that was supposed to be of the landing site was no boulders. So we knew there was something wrong, but didn't know what. And what in fact was happening was that they were 4 miles long. And at the point where they would have been landing on a site, they were over a big boulder field and couldn't. So he had to find somewhere himself. A landing site nobody knew anything about, just beyond the boulders. And, you know, he put the landing craft down there, the lunar module, After 240,000 miles and 3 days' journey, he landed there with 19 seconds of fuel left, and that's what you call nerves of steel. And we didn't know that. You know, we thought it was hairy enough.
You visited the Kennedy Space Center for Tomorrow's World in 1968. Could you describe what it was like actually sitting in the Apollo Command Module?
Yes, small. I mean, you realize that those guys have to be extremely psychologically very stable people to spend 3 days with three guys, no, 8 days really, with three guys in a thing that small. I mean, it was as small as the inside of a Volkswagen Beetle. And that's pretty small. And I mean, even getting in and looking around and being able to move freely, they all said, of course, it was made much easier by zero gravity because you could float into funny little positions where you could never have been had there been any gravity. So they said it kind of doubled the size. But even so, it's a very, very small spacecraft.
The current Radio Times is running an editorial that you wrote to accompany the moon landing 50 years ago,
yes,
alongside a new editorial. And it's interesting to see in the original that there's a glossary of terms.
Yeah, that's right.
And how important was that at the time? And in a general sense, the educational side of the Apollo 11 mission?
Well, the glossary of terms was there because, you know, the general public didn't know any of these words at all because we had not done many broadcasts. But, you know, during Apollo 11, on the rare occasion when you got to go out of the television center, in a cab, the taxi drivers were using phrases like mid-course correction, you know, which they'd never used before. And everybody suddenly got turned on to this new language. In terms of its general effect, I believe, and I think a lot of the people in the educational world have told me, that Apollo 11 really boosted the interest of young people in science and technology in general. And I think they feel boosted the number of people going on to university to study science and technology rather than the arts. So I think it had that major effect.
And 50 years on, what do you feel is the most important legacy of the moon landing?
Well, clearly, of course, that view of the planet, which then became known as the blue dot in the middle of nothing, and an awareness that this is the only place we have and there's nowhere else easily to go to, so we better look after it. And the other thing I think was often not talked about, management. NASA got 300,000 people in 2,500 companies to design and build 5 million and 5.5 million separate bits to make up the launch vehicle and the spacecraft. And all of those bits had to fit together in what then became known as zero defect engineering. And they managed that. And I think if anything, Apollo did far more for management than it did for science and technology.
You're appearing at this year's Blue Dot Festival, taking place very soon.
At Jodrell Bank.
What are you looking forward to?
Fortunately, I don't have to work very hard. I'm going to be interviewed. But I think they're going to run clips of stuff. And sometimes you forget you did something. I'm not happy to see it again. I'm thinking particularly of my weightless flight, which I look back on it with horror, the way I did it.
To finish, can I ask you what it was like when you visited NASA at Kennedy Space Center?
Yeah.
Was the security intense and was it difficult getting in?
Yes. Well, first of all, it was very easy to get into the press center, of course. And I mean, that's a big difference between NASA and the Russians. I mean, you know, I went to Moscow a few times to Star City and everything was heavy security and you did nothing without clearance. And clearance was only given usually for you to talk to a pre-scripted general. There's no question of looking around. NASA was exactly the opposite. I mean, if a door was open and a person was standing there, you go through the door and talk to the person. The only doors you couldn't go through at any old time was in the mission control room itself, because if they were doing something, you certainly didn't want pokey journalists coming in. But when they weren't online, as it were, running a mission, you could walk in there and do anything you liked. So it was an extraordinarily open environment. However, of course, it was an open environment because NASA, you know, NASA needed the support from the press because they needed the support from public opinion because they needed the money. And you know, part of NASA's openness was to make sure the public continued to be excited by the project and therefore continue to approve the expenditure.
That was James Burke. To find out more about what happened during the Apollo missions as a whole, why not pick up our special edition, The Apollo Story, on sale now? There's lots to see in the night sky this month, which you can read all about in our Sky Guide.
But of course, with the Apollo 11 anniversary, most people are going to have their eyes on our nearest neighbour, the Moon. The pitted lunar surface is covered with interesting craters and mountains to see, but the best time to look for them is when the line between the light and dark side of the Moon, known as the Terminator, is nearby. It just so happens that on the night of the landing's anniversary, the 20 to the 21st of July, the Terminator will be perfectly placed in the Sea of Tranquility to show off the Apollo 11 landing site. Grab a moon map or the Apollo Observing Guide in the August issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine and use landmarks such as craters and lunar mare to find them. Though we are much too far away to make out the landers on the surface, even with the world's most powerful telescopes, you can still see the area where the team touched down. So that's it from us this month. You can find out more about Apollo 11 in the July and August issue of BBC Sky at Night magazine, where we give you a rundown of the Apollo 11 mission, talk to a geologist who is studying freshly unfrozen Apollo moon rock samples, and take a look back at the mission's legacy. And that's not forgetting our regular sections that will help you unlock the wonders of the night sky, find the right equipment to observe it with, and discover the best things to see after dark this month. Don't forget, you can learn more about the Apollo program as a whole in our special edition, The Apollo Story, or follow our coverage of the event on our website, www.skyatnightmagazine.com. From all of us here at BBC Sky at Night magazine, goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Radio Astronomy Podcast from the makers of BBC Sky at Night magazine, which was produced in our Bristol studio by Jack Bateman and Ben Hewitt. For more of our podcasts, visit our website at skyatnightmagazine.com or simply head to iTunes.